I'm Indy Neidell, and this, once again, is the Great War Podcast. Now, in the background behind me is Flo, our producer. Say hi, Flo.
Hi.
So you might hear him chime in from time to time, and he's very important. But who's even more important today is our guest. Our guest today is Aaron Pegram. He's a historian. He works for the Australian War Memorial. Now, we have had him before as a guest, but we thought him so fascinating that we thought we'd have him again because today is a day that we may wish to talk about certain events that happened today and led into other things. And that's enough of me talking. Aaron, can you say hello to all the people out there who are not your friends on Facebook and so they don't know what we're going to talk about? And then let's get talking, okay?
Okay, hi guys. It's good to be back on the show. I'm a longtime supporter of both the YouTube channel and also the podcast. So to everybody involved in both of those enterprises, congratulations for your success and sort of delivering or teaching us about the First World War in a very new and engaging way.
Well, you can imagine how much fun it is to actually do this. I mean, I can't believe it's. It's nearly, we've been doing this for 4 years. I mean, that's just crazy when you think about it. You know, an acting job that's 4 years long, a writing job that's 4 years long, a history job that's 4 years long, and it's the same job, you know?
Yeah. And it goes for the duration of the First World War itself. So, and no doubt in many respects, you've also been refighting the First World War on many fronts.
Oh, yes. Yes, very, very, very much so. But it's a... When I think how long we've been doing this channel, you sort of realize how long the war actually really went. You say 4 years, that doesn't sound that long, but it feels that long when you're actually writing it week after week after week. Now, we are here at the end of May in our world in 1918. And so I'll ask you now at the end of May in 2018, what is special about just today?
So today is a fairly significant day in the history of the Australian Imperial Force, as the Australian forces are known during the First World War, because on this day, 100 years ago, Lieutenant General Sir John Monash is appointed commander of the recently formed Australia Corps, which comprises of 5 infantry divisions. And that's significant for a number of reasons, primarily because in Australia, Monash is revered as this significant Australian who led the Australia Corps through its most successful campaign of the war. I mean, you guys have spoken about the Australians on the YouTube channel and also on the podcast. But to give you a sense of where Australia was in 1914, we were a very young nation. Australia had only just federated 13 years before. We had a permanent military in Australia, although it was very, very small. We had a citizens' military force in Australia, which was for home defence only. So when Britain declares war on Germany in August 1914. Australia is automatically at war, but we don't actually have an army that we can send overseas. So in 1914, we have a newly formed military force that's referred to as the Australian Imperial Force, comprised entirely of volunteers, and that remains so through the duration of the war. We fight on Gallipoli and on the Western Front, and also in the Middle East, in Sinai and Palestine. And generally, by 1918, the Australians had suffered over, I think it's a 230,000 battle casualties, and which includes 60,000 war dead. But what's significant about 1918 is that the Australians are no longer fighting under British command. We'd started the war with one infantry division, and by 1916, the Australian forces had expanded to 5 infantry divisions, which all goes and see combat on the Western Front. We fight on the Somme in 1916, at Pozières, at Mouquet Farm. We're involved in the pursuit of the Germans during their withdrawal to the Hindenburg Line. Some fairly nasty actions at around Bullecourt in April and May 1917. At Messines in June 1917, and then, of course, during the infamous Battle of Ypres. And there, in just a period of 8 weeks, the Australians suffer over 38,000 casualties, and their largest losses of the war. 1918 is a real game changer because we are now fighting as a corps. Those 5 infantry divisions had been grouped together in late 1917. The Australians were fortunately spared the full weight of the German spring offensive. We were still holding parts of the line up near Ypres after the Third Battle of Ypres, when the German spring offensive hit British 3rd and 5th Armies on the Somme. And some of the Australian brigades are rushed south to help defend Amiens during the German spearhead towards Amiens as part of Operation Michael. So the Australians, they play a significant role in terms of the Allied offensive that's fought by British 4th Army. We heard from David Boris on the podcast a few months ago about the role of the Canadians, who, and from mid-1918 onwards, the Canadians and the Australians play a significant role in spearheading that offensive on the British 4th Army front along the Somme River. There's also the British 3rd Corps to the north and also to the French much further south. But Monash is revered as this great national hero in Australia because, as some of the popular writers have recently said, he won the war. He is Australia's greatest senior commander who harnessed all who led the Australians through the most significant victories and probably single-handedly did more to ensure the Australians played a significant role in those victories in the latter half of 1918.
Now, when he was given command over 200,000 Australians or something 100 years ago, there's a lot of pushback against that, though. There were a lot of people that did not want him in command. Yes.
That's right. I mean, Monash is an odd character in many respects, but some of the popular sentiment in Australia recently, there's been an undercurrent of a movement against sort of elevating Monash for greater recognition here in Australia. Documentaries have sort of labelled him the forgotten Anzac, he's... Popular histories have considered him as the outsider who won the war. And this all stems from the way in which he was portrayed, or the way in which he was dealt with by other Australian senior commanders during the war years. Monash is a first-generation Australian. His parents were from Prussia, and they were Jewish, and they emigrated to Australia in the 1850s. And Monash's Prussian Jewish heritage really sort of it doesn't sit too favourably in Australia in 1914, in the German, massive German sort of anti-German sentiment in the country at the time. Monash, as a civilian, as a very bright and very capable Australian commander by 1914. He's a civilian engineer in his civilian life. He has over 30 years experience in the civilian military forces. And in 1914, when the Australian Imperial Force is formed, he's a colonel and he's given command of the Australian 4th Brigade, which fights on Gallipoli. There's some sort of scepticism and rumour in Australia and in Egypt and also in London that Monash was a spy. Rumours had circulated that he had been arrested and shot as such, and this certainly wasn't the case at all.
It'd be an amazing like coup for us if today's podcast you said new evidence has come to light saying that John Monash was in fact a spy and was in fact executed in 1914 and the other guy was an imposter.
So I mean, John Monash certainly does attract a fair amount of criticism from his contemporaries in 1914 and throughout the duration of the war. The Australian war correspondent and later official historian, Charles Bean, took a disliking to Monash, even as his corps commander, in the lead up to him being appointed to corps commander. Bean had some fairly archaic views of people with Jewish characteristics. He thought that Monash was self-seeking, a self-promoter, was hungry for decoration and recognition. These attitudes did exist at the time, but it certainly didn't stop Monash from becoming the great commander that he was. I mean, in 1914, as I said, he was a brigade commander. He led the 4th Brigade on Gallipoli, during the fighting on Gallipoli, with some mixed success, but he also commanded the 3rd Australian Division from 1916 through to 1917 on the Western Front, fighting at Messines and Passchendaele. And there he became quite well known for his meticulous planning, and perhaps that's an extension of his civilian life as an engineer. In late 1917, early 18, where it became clear that the five Australian infantry divisions would be regrouped to form the Australia Corps, Monash is probably one of the only sort of commanders that the Australian Imperial Force has that's both Australian and has command experience at commanding an infantry division. The other contender is General Cyril Brudenell White, who is the chief of staff of Sir William Birdwood, the Australia Corps commander, a British general, but of course he doesn't have command experience of an infantry division. So much has been said about the prejudice and the sort of undercurrent of dissatisfaction that potentially a Prussian Jew would command the Australia Corps in 1918. It certainly doesn't stop Monash from reaching that command position. He's has a proven track record of being a very fine and very capable and very skilled commander. He's one of those senior commanders who is willing to learn and adopt new technologies, such as the use of tanks and aircraft and new artillery methods and doctrine, and the way in which that can fit into the way in which the infantry carry out their attack. And I think that's a very significant quality to have in a senior commander. It's also been said that Monash won the war, and that his tactics employed during the Battle of Hamel and also during the fighting at Amiens on the 8th of August 1918 was sort of the antecedent of the Blitzkrieg tactics used by the Wehrmacht in Europe during the Second World War, and that's absolute nonsense. Monash certainly did not invent the way in which the British Army were fighting by 1918, but he certainly benefited from the tactical lessons and the new technologies that had been learned by the British Expeditionary Force as a whole between 1914 and 1918. And perhaps Australians consider Hamel this great turning point in the war, because from there onwards the Australians play a significant part in the Fourth Army's successes on the Western Front. But perhaps other historians would argue that the Battle of Cambrai and other actions that where the British Army had achieved a breakthrough were far more important on a tactical level. So these are some of the issues that are kicking around in Australia at the moment. But, I mean, what's really interesting is that during the length of the duration of the First World War centenary, it would be fair to say that most Australians, when they thought of the First World War, they probably would have thought of Gallipoli. But now, when Australians think of the fighting in the First World War, they probably think of the Western Front. But the real sort of threat here is that perhaps the pendulum may have swung the other way. And that by looking at John Monash and his successes, that perhaps the Australians have this the real sort of threat there of overstating our importance in the fighting on the Western Front. So yeah.
Well, let's talk for a minute about Hamel, and because that was only what five and 6 weeks after Monash took command, and it is I think it is fairly important for not necessarily as a turning point for the war on the whole, but as a showcase for combined doctrine, a combined defensive doctrine. Can you talk about what actually happened there as opposed to what the myths about Hamel?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So for those of you who are playing at home, Hamel is, or Le Hamel, is this tiny little village in the Somme region of northern France, and it's just about 3 or 4 kilometres east of the town of Villers-Bretonneux. And for much of the war, Le Hamel and Villers-Bretonneux had been very much in the rear of the British rear area. The front line in 1916 was probably about 15 to 20 kilometres away. But this whole area becomes of critical importance, mainly because the Germans achieved their decisive, achieve a major breakthrough on the British Fifth Army front, and they get to within almost artillery range of the city of Amiens. I mean, from Villers-Bretonneux, from Hill 104, just north of Villers-Bretonneux, you can actually see Amiens. That's how close the Imperial German Army actually got to not only just capturing Amiens, but also, from Hill 104, you can see it. That means you can shell it and disrupt the vital supply line between the British and French armies. So as I said before, I mean, the Australians are in Belgium during the German Spring Offensive, but various brigades are rushed south to help defend parts of the line. And when Operation Michael sort of runs its course, the frontline positions on this particular front are around the Villers-Bretonneux-Hamel area. In May 1918, the Australian Corps is given responsibility for this sector, and we're right up against the Somme River. On the Australian Corps front, actually, it sits astride the Somme River between Albert and Villers-Bretonneux. What's happening at this point is sort of a whole series of minor engagements along the line as the line begins to settle. And in July 1918, Monash conducts what's referred to as the Battle of Hamel, and it's fought on the 4th of July 1918, and it involves a small number of American infantry. It obviously involves elements of the Australia Corps. It involves massive amounts of artillery from British and French and Australian artillery units. It involves the British Tank Corps and about 60 of the brand spanking new Mark V tanks and air assets from the Australian Flying Corps and also the Royal Air Force, which in essence are all operating together to straighten a slight bend in the line. So this battle is made along a 6-kilometer front, and the intention is to straighten the line by advancing 2 kilometers. And that's it. We're not trying to achieve a decisive breakthrough, because the lessons of the past have taught us that when we do finally achieve a decisive breakthrough, it's very difficult to bring up stores of supplies and resupply troops who have achieved that breakthrough and bring up fuel for tanks, but also it leaves assaulting units prone to German counterattack. So Hamel is not sort of the antecedent of Blitzkrieg. We have a very definite objective line. Monash plans this operation to last 90 minutes, and at 0 hour at 3:10 a.m. on the 4th of July 1918, everything goes according to plan. The infantry are where they're supposed to be. The tanks do what they're supposed to do. The Australian Flying Corps and the Royal Air Force are dropping ammunition boxes by parachute to designated positions on the ground. The infantry sweep over and take their objectives, and it's all over in 93 minutes. So it's a very stunning success for the Australian Corps, who are for the very first time fighting under an Australian commander who has a proven track record for meticulous planning, for harnessing new and innovative technologies and also new tactics as well. So the successes at Hamel go back into what Flo has been referring to as the feedback loop as part of the British Expeditionary Force's tactical learning and development, and goes on to play an important role in the way in which senior commanders are thinking about how they're going to be conducting the main main offensive effort at Amiens on the 8th of August 1918. So, I mean, that's what ultimately happens. Hamel, in Australia, it's by some popular historians have referred to it as the 93 minutes that changed the world. I mean, that's a massive overreach, and that just simply is not true.
Now, just a side note, when you mentioned the supply drop there, I read in Martin Gilbert that was the first supply drop done during an actual battle. Is that correct? Do you know if there...
It's not. The short answer is no, it's not. I mean, the Royal Air Force, the Royal Flying Corps had been developing, or at least been thinking about aerial resupply since 1915, and in fact, there's actual aerial resupply of British ground troops at Kut in Mesopotamia in 1916. There is evidence to suggest that the German air service had dropped ammunition, rations, and grenades to ground troops during their offensive in Flanders in May 1918. And certainly at Hamel, Monash is fairly keen for an inventor in the number three squadron Australian Flying Corps to develop a method for dropping ammunition to ground troops via parachute. So this is one of the misnomers and myths about the fighting at Hamel. I find it quite interesting that there is this almost parallel development. I mean, at Hamel, Monash is probably informed by the German use of ammunition resupply during the offensives, which indicates that perhaps the British Expeditionary Force as a whole was learning some of its tactical lessons from the Germans. But I think the whole notion of this whole tactic of ammunition resupply by air is a little bit overcooked, because as part of the infantry assault are those 50 tanks. And some of those tanks, I think there's about four of them, are supply tanks. And they're obsolete Mark V tanks, which don't carry any guns. And they've got in big white letters written on the side, supply. And they're carrying up more water for machine guns, ammunition, medical supplies, and trench stores than what three or four RE8s involved in this particular action are able to actually drop from the air. So yet again, it's the tanks that assist the infantry, not air power.
Very good that we talked about this just now, because we've got filming today and tomorrow, and we will be filming those July episodes, and that would be... It's good to know, so I don't actually say something that's not entirely true. But it's funny because I love reading Martin Gilbert, the First World War. I think he's got a lot of great anecdotes. What I've discovered is a few of them you do have to take with a grain of salt or have to do a little digging into. Brilliant book for stories, though. Absolutely, you know.
Every sort of dominion of the British Expeditionary Force, and I'm sure this is like many of the listeners and viewers of the podcast, every nation probably has this little sort of association with the First World War, and that was their contribution to the war. I was, because we're leading up to the centenary of the fighting at Hamel, and because the Australians are so passionate and about their staking their claims on the actions they fought in 1918. I'm very interested in actually teasing apart some of these myths and actually having a look at, say, for example, the tactics that are employed at Hamel. When were they first used? Another one is the clever use of the obsolete aircraft to sort of fly over the German lines and create enough noise that it masks the sound of tank engines. That perhaps is another one that is attributed to Monash and his meticulous planning. But I was very surprised to read in Nick Lloyd's recent book on Passchendaele, your very first podcast episode, he references that particular tactic to the action on the Cockcroft at Polkapel in August 1917. The Royal Flying Corps had done just that in Belgium in 1917. And certainly there was evidence to suggest the Royal Flying Corps was doing it at Cambrai in November 1917. So, I mean, what I find interesting about this is that the Australians, as part of the British Expeditionary Force, are receptive to the same lessons that are being learned in other formations, the feedback loop that Flo has been discussing previously. And this is when the British Expeditionary Force as a whole is beginning to hit its stride. It's beginning to understand the importance of firepower and the integrated use of armor and infantry and air assets. And of course, the theory of attacks with a limited objectives, not to try and punch a hole through German lines and keep on going. It's just to go a little bit, that 2 kilometers, so that you don't bite off more than what you can chew.
before.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'll say it like that then. And speaking of perhaps overinflating what happened at a battle or its importance or the events of it, there's been a lot of that. We've seen a bunch of that in the comments about Villiers-Bretonneux, actually, which happened a couple months before Hamel, before Monash was even elevated to overall command of the Australians. What about that? What do people have to say about that now?
Yeah. For those of you who don't know a terrible lot about the fighting at Villiers-Bretonneux, it's one of these actions that are fought during the final stages of Operation Michael, after the German forces have overrun part of the British Fifth Army's positions, and they're now within striking distance of Amiens. From Hill 104, just north of Villiers-Bretonneux, if the Germans could reach the top of it, they could see Amiens. And if they could see Amiens, that means they could shell it. The thing is, before I get into that, the Australians play an important role in the fighting around Villiers-Bretonneux. On the 24th of April, the three German divisions carry out an assault with tanks, and succeed in capturing Villiers-Bretonneux, overrunning the British 8th Division. And the British 8th Division are forced to withdraw, and the Germans have hunkered down. There is an engagement between the British Tank Corps and the German A7Vs, which are put into the line, and that in the end becomes the first tank on tank battle in modern warfare. So in some respects, Villiers-Bretonneux is very important for that reason. The Australians, as I said, are spared the massive casualties of the German spring offensive, and two Australian brigades, the 13th Brigade under Tom Glasgow and the 15th Brigade under Pompey Elliott, carry out a very splendid counterattack in a very pincer-like manoeuvre and recapture the town from German troops. It's actually quite well known for its vicious bayonet fighting, and there's some very graphic accounts of the Australians attacking in the middle of the night under the illumination of flares and this ferocious roar on both sides of the village as they get stuck into the German units then digging in at Villiers-Bretonneux. So the fighting involves those two Australian brigades on what is then the third anniversary of the Gallipoli landings. Another important sort of ring for the Australians there, and of course with some of the British troops who had been ejected from the town, and they succeed in recapturing Villiers-Bretonneux. And the way in which Villiers-Bretonneux is talked about in Australia is the Australians at Villiers-Bretonneux stopped the German spring offensive, and that is probably what Flo is talking about. I mean, that's another misnomer. By the time the Australians are ordered to counterattack at Villiers-Bretonneux, the German troops that are on the Somme, that have been involved in Operation Michael, their offensive is done. They cannot advance any further. Not only have the Germans suffered enormous casualties, mainly from NCOs and officers, junior leaders who have been leading this offensive from the front, they've outstripped their supply lines. The German army has been undergoing material shortages for years now, and supplies and ammunition and reinforcements are not being bought up. They're simply unable to. And there's also a major failing in the German senior high command as well, who splintered the German attacking forces. There may be some ground gained on one level, but then the reinforcements that are designated for one particular sector are moved up to the north for another major effort. And then there's another switch. So, I mean, the German senior commanders rob the offensive of any hope of success. So it's within this context that the Australians counterattack. We may seem to think that we've saved Amiens single-handedly because the British who were there, were rubbish, as the Australians tended to think that they were. That's not the case at all. The British troops who have been fought on the Somme, who were forced to withdraw, were actually proved a lot more resilient than what the popular accounts suggest, and absolutely, the Australians play for a number of very successful defensive actions in that area, at Dernancourt, for example, near Albert, two understrength Australian brigades held off an attack by three German divisions in what was a very ferocious, very vicious close quarter engagement. There was some more fighting at a place called Hebertern and up in the north at Strazil. But by then, when we have a look at the higher direction of the war, I mean, the German offensive was pretty much spent. They were not going to be coming, they were in no position to be able to capture Amiens. So part of what I've been doing recently has been trying to situate the Australian experience in a much broader context as to what's been happening on the Western Front, not necessarily look at the Australian experience through the lens of a drinking straw, but what else was happening, not just within the British Expeditionary Force, but all Allied armies and, of course, the Imperial German Army.
Is something that we've been trying to do for 4 years, to look at the whole, an even bigger picture of, 14 battlefronts and stuff. You and I are friends on Facebook, so I saw when it was posted, the video you posted last week, the YouTube video. We'll have a link to that, right, so everybody can watch that. Everybody, you're going to have to watch that because it's really interesting. It's a great speech. As you can tell, he's a really good talker. You just turn him on and he just goes and goes and goes, kind of like me, actually. Flo, is there anything else we wanted to specifically discuss? Or Aaron, is there anything I'm forgetting?
Did we talk about Mephisto the last time?
No, we talked about it with Ralph Ratz, but that was that. but we can talk. Say a few words about Mephisto if you like. I mean, you guys have it.
When you say we, you guys, I mean, Mephisto is an A7V tank, one of some 20 that were developed by Germany during the latter stages of the war. My understanding is the German Germany was probably more keen at producing submarines or U-boats than what it was in embracing the idea of tank technology. I think what's interesting about Germany during the First World War is its wartime economy. It's completely geared towards fighting this war on multiple fronts and does so at the expense of the needs of civilians at home. I mean, no one had anticipated the length and duration of the war. I mean, the war was supposed to be a very swift victory, firstly against France and Britain and then against Russia. But of course, it bogs down into a stalemate, and then Germany's fighting a war on multiple fronts for a long period of time, which then drains it of its ability to produce both tanks and submarines. It's either tanks or submarines. So anyway, long story short, Mephisto is one of these 20 A7V tanks which get produced during the war. And if any of you have actually seen an A7V, it's not exactly a vehicle with a small profile. It's I think it's crewed by about 12 men, and it's bristling with MG08 machine guns, and doesn't actually have a maximum speed. But anyway, Mephisto was involved in the fighting around Villers-Bretonneux, where it's involved in breaking through part of that British line. It ultimately gets ditched in a shell hole, and its crew are unable to recover it, and then so they abandon it on the battlefield. And so when the Australians take over part of the line around Villers-Bretonneux, Mephisto is sort of out in no man's land. And it ultimately gets recovered by a Queensland battalion. And the Queenslanders are very passionate about their ownership of Mephisto because after the war, Mephisto was brought back to the Australia with the intention of coming back to the Australian War Memorial. It got off the dock in Brisbane, and because of that association, it remained in Queensland for decades. And in fact, Mephisto, it formed part of the Queensland Museum, and it is now part of the Queensland Museum. But the Queensland Museum were very generous enough to actually let the Australian War Memorial, to loan Mephisto to the Australian War Memorial, where it could be viewed by people outside of Queensland.
Outside of Queensland, yeah, we did a really fun special at the German Tank Museum with Ralph Ratz, the guy who's the, like the curator of the museum, on just the A7V. And I'm just throwing that to everybody out there in listening land. You can totally search for that on our YouTube channel. It's very, very good.
The replica is built of the schematic, like of the measurements from Mephisto. Actually.
Oh yeah, the replica of Mephisto that they have in the German Tech Museum is built from the schematics of the actual one that you guys have, right?
That doesn't surprise me whatsoever. I mean, while Mephisto was in Canberra, I was very fortunate enough to be able to actually look inside and sit inside Mephisto. So
we got to sit inside the replica, actually. So we both got it, That was a big eye opener, the A7V stuff. Actually, yesterday I got given, I think one of the best things about my particular job as the writer and host of the channel is that people give me stuff, war related stuff. And this guy that was with us on that trip, but talking about rations and stuff, he made a A7V Zippo for me.
Wow.
He took a Zippo lighter and made a little A7V, and it's glued on, so it looks like you bought it and stuff, but it's an A7V Zippo. And he says, however, it's not unique because he made himself one too. So there's
two
of
them.
That's
cool. That's really
cool. Yeah. That was really, really nice. What else? Anything else, Flo? Okay, well then I suppose I should do some kind of wrap up. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't?
Yeah, look, mentioned? No, nothing special. But look, I'm going to be visiting France throughout June and July in the next couple of weeks. I'll be leading two commercial battlefield tours of the Western Front. I'm always very keen to catch up with people who listen to the podcast and talk shop whenever we're in the same location. So please, I mean, I'll be tweeting about my activities on the Western Front battlefields and places that I'll be visiting. It'll be great to actually catch up with some of the listeners and talk shop and perhaps refight the First World War over a few pints in the evening. So, more than happy to do that.
Well, that's great. And I'll tell you what, on our Facebook and stuff, we'll keep people posted as to your whereabouts too. So if anybody out there, you want to meet Aaron firsthand and bend his ear with tales of, well, stuff he probably knows a lot about already, you can certainly go and do that. Flo, you had something you want to say?
Is there a chance that his trip is going to last until the 1st or 2nd of August?
Yeah, is there a chance your trip will last until the 1st or 2nd of August?
Sadly, I will be back on a plane flying from Paris back to Sydney on the 27th of July. So.
Because the 1st of August, we're going on the road again, and we'll be in France and Belgium and Britain from the 1st to the 10th of August. It'd be so great if we could actually do something in real life.
Yeah.
We'll have to do it one day, though.
Like,
you know?
Land ships in the night, as they say.
Aha. Uh-huh. You see what he did? You see what he did there, guys? World War I humor. It's brilliant. Okay, well, Aaron Pegram, thank you very, very much for taking time to talk to us again. And I guarantee we'll have him back another time later in the year. So if you're not tired of his voice, you'll hear him again in a few months. You can meet him on the Western Front in June and July. He'll be tweeting about that. We'll definitely be tweeting and posting on Facebook when he tells us where he is. And I think that's about it for today. Aaron, say goodbye to everybody.
Goodbye, everybody, and thank you very much for listening to this excellent podcast series. Again, congratulations to Flo and Indy for telling the very complex story of the First World War to a very wide and general audience. You guys are doing a fantastic job, so please keep up the good work.
And with that complimentary note, I'll let everybody go. Okay, guys, we'll talk to you all soon. All right, thanks, Aaron. See you.